KZS on KMOX. Happy Thursday to you. I had to think about it there because yesterday was my Monday and Janelle, forget it. Wheels is out until Monday. You're welcome, and we apologize. So it goes both ways, trust me.
It's always weird when anyone's gone, because it's like family dinner is a person short. The vibe is going to be different.
I think it's most weird when Wheeler's gone, because he talks so much.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, he fills so much space, which I appreciate.
I'm going to argue and say it's most weird when Dave Glover is gone on the Dave Glover Show.
Yeah, I never listen. Kidding. Attorney Brad Young joins us. Hello, Brad.
Hey, Dave.
Question. Can you do two segments today?
Absolutely.
Awesome. Then I want to start with politics. And though I don't even want to say this because it just makes me seem insane, but I'm so mad at Trump, as use, because he trolls me effectively. Mm-hmm. And like yesterday when he was saying, I've been right about everything, I'm like, dude, I have a supercut of 40 times you told us the war in Iran was over in the last 8 weeks, and you were wrong every one of those times. And then a reporter asked him yesterday, like, hey, a week ago you said that the Iranians you're dealing with were rational and good people. And he said, what changed? He goes, I got to know them. That's what being wrong looks like. Like, you took in more information, you changed your mind, you were wrong in the first place. It just makes me insane.
It does. And part of that, I think, is by design. I think his style is such that by doing that, his opponents become emotional.
Yeah.
I mean, think about this. I lose like 95% of my arguments with my wife, okay? Now, in the real world, I win like 80 something percent of them. But with my wife, I lose almost all of them. Why? Because when I get emotional, then I am unable to argue effectively. And I think Trump has really mastered that art of making his opponents furious. Mm-hmm. And then when they're furious, they lose the ability for rational thought.
Mm-hmm. You're so right.
I don't know if that's intentional on his part, if it's something that he's learned.
Yeah.
Or whether it's, you know, I don't know where it came from,
yeah.
But I do know that it's a style that he has effectively mastered either intentionally or unintentionally.
So setting that aside, how do you handicap this thing with the war in Iran? What are you seeing?
Well, what am I seeing? What I'm seeing at this point is that Iran wants to exercise territorial control over the Strait of Hormuz. And that's even more than what they were previously allowed to do, because there are international guidelines. Your international waters go out a certain amount of space. I think it's like 5 miles from the coast. And so there have been these unofficial rules about how the strait operates so that everyone can transit that effectively. Iran's trying to change that equation by saying they control the strait. That's never going to happen. It's never going to happen, not just because of Trump, but the Saudi Arabia is never going to allow that to happen. UAE, Bahrain, none of them are going to allow that to happen. So if that becomes a point that they stick with, I foresee continued hostilities. Because look, and this isn't getting reported much, but I read in the Wall Street Journal late last night that the UAE was even firing missiles and drones at Iran, in defense, right? So these other oil producing states are going to ensure that Iran does not take over territorial control of the strait. So the whole thing at that point comes down to this: if they insist on control, hostilities will continue. If they agree to negotiate away from control, I think a deal can be reached.
Okay, I have a couple thoughts. I think the Trump administration, I started to say we, but it's not we, because other presidents didn't fall for the trap. I think the Trump administration has miscalculated Iran in a couple very big ways. And to me, they're pretty obvious ways. Like, I've known this for a long time. I don't know why they didn't. But first of all, they don't care about their people. Like, we care about our children. If you and I are in a fight That's one thing. But then if you somehow bring my kids in and threaten them, it's like, oh, hold on. This horse of a different color. They don't care. Yep. So if we knocked out their infrastructure and the desalination plants and things like that, so long as they have water and light, they're okay. And then the second thing is, I don't think the regime wants peace. I can't imagine in my lifetime without true regime change. I can't imagine anything that looks like the current regime or the past regime ever making a deal and really sticking with it, because I don't think they want it. They don't live for peace. They live for war. They live for taking over and Sharia law and the whole thing. And fine, that's what you do. But when they're your opponent, I think you have to put that into the algorithm, and just sinking their navy to the bottom of the ocean doesn't do that.
Well, you're 100% correct on that, Dave. And I think the administration knew that to a large measure, because the very opening salvos in February were all focused squarely on taking out the Iranian governmental leadership. I mean, that's what they were trying to do. They killed the Ayatollah. They've presumably, at least according to reports, his son is severely injured. In fact, he may have even lost a leg. They took out scores of generals. That was the initial thrust. Take out the leadership. And once you take out the leadership, the hope was is that the people would rise up. The problem is that there was enough scattered government officials to maintain control. Mm-hmm. And so that never happened. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, they're buried in. You're not going to find them now. And so the likelihood of there being regime change is slim to none at this point. So I think they knew it. And I think that's why they tried to take out that leadership. Where do we go from here? Oh, I 100% agree with you. They're not rational in terms of trying to protect their country. They're trying to protect their own power and to foster their version of conflict on the world, because that gives them presence. And it gives them power when other countries are afraid of them. And also, don't forget, by empowering Hezbollah, they're also continuing to take on through these third parties, but they're continuing to take on directly fighting Israel. So, no, yeah. I don't think you're ever going to have true peace. The only thing that goes in favor of maybe some kind of peace is that the February war knocked out most of the factories that Iran has that could produce these missiles and drones. And so that will have an impact. We saw them launching missiles recently, but that can only go so far, because they're going to run out of munitions and they don't have the ability to restock.
Yeah. And I hate to say it, but maybe the only effective thing would just be like, hey, look, every time you guys get up on your feet, we're going to knock you down again. So stay on your knees. Like, all this fancy pants, pie in the sky peace talks, we're never going to be peaceful with them. They're never going to be peaceful with their neighbors. It's just who they are. It's like the frog and the scorpion.
Oh, 100% right. And Trump, and again, Trump says a lot of things, and I try not to listen to too much of what Trump says. I look at what he does, because what he says is kind of meaningless. What he does has meaning. He said on Air Force One yesterday that every time they hit us once, we're going to hit them 20 times. And what we've seen over the last 24, 48 hours is that, in effect, that the strike ratio, maybe not exactly 20 to 1, but it is elevated. So I think that's the current posture, to try to, as you put it, keep them on their knees, at least politically, militarily, aggressively, keep them on their knees, force them into an agreement. And then when they break that agreement, then you could build a coalition of countries to come in and put a stop to it.
Brad, what is your take on this crazy weekend at Bernie's Mitch McConnell thing that's going on?
Well, you know, it's not, this isn't new. All right. Every time there have been times in the past when senators have been wheeled in on gurneys with IV bottles stuck in their arms to come in and cast votes. All right. If you've got a pulse, you can vote. And I think that's what's going on right now. Obviously, with Mitch, he's not in good shape. But the real issue is that you look at Beshear in Kentucky, and he has a legitimate need to know, is Mitch McConnell alive or on life support? Because the consequences are the state has to replace him. And so the governor is empowered to do that. And he could even, in theory, appoint himself to the U.S. Senate. Mm. I don't think he would do that because it looks bad, but he could do it in theory. Mm-hmm. So it's a legitimate question, and silence always begets speculation, right?
True.
So when you don't hear anything from the Mitch McConnell camp, then you've got these AI pictures that are floating around of Mitch looking like he's on life support on board the Starship Enterprise. You know, they got all these things keeping him alive. I don't think that's real. But the question is, if you don't provide answers, you allow then people to speculate.
He's evidently capable of having several 17-minute phone conversations per day.
Wow, and that makes him qualified to be a U.S. senator. I mean, come on. You got to be able to do more than have a couple of conversations on the phone. And listen, the real issue is if someone's sick and they're under the weather, so to speak, if there's a likelihood that you're going to get better, then you roll with it. But if he's on a downward trajectory towards life support, at that point, the mechanisms need to be triggered to go forward with his replacement.
All right, we're talking to our buddy attorney Brad Young. Going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk about a couple of interesting court cases, and we'll get Brad's opinion on the Plattner deal in Maine. Welcome back, guys. DJS and KMOX 222, talking to attorney Brad Young. This Plattner guy in Maine, and I'm not trying to be whatever here, but we're used to hearing these kind of allegations about Republicans, and now we have a Democrat with all this dirty laundry and allegations of rape, what do you think? I mean, take it over.
Well, before I dive into that, I got to tell you, every bumper song you played today was from my was exactly from my playlist when I was rocking the VFWs in Southern Illinois in the 80s.
Love it.
Just letting you know that.
Love it. Yeah.
But back to your question. Listen, this whole thing really comes down to two things. I think if I could simplify it down to two particular issues. Number one, I think the broader story here is not that Graham Plattner is dropping out. It's one race. It's one guy. We've seen this rise fit this national pattern of anti-establishment, Bernie-style, Democrat socialist or progressive populists, and they're gaining traction, okay? And this doesn't necessarily slow that down. But what it does expose is that when you have these situations where people are anti-establishment, they're populist, they don't come from the elected ranks, they rise up and run for office, these people aren't properly vetted. And when you have, I don't care, on either side, look, Trump wasn't vetted, and he still got elected because of, I think, his overwhelming personality. But listen, if he were a regular politician, he never would have made it through the primary with his background. So when you have these populist people, whether it's on the right or on the left or somewhere in between, when they're not properly vetted by the electoral process, then you risk what we're seeing play out right here, which is people coming out of the woodwork, people making allegations. It happens over and over and over again with these anti-establishment people on the right and left. So that's the risk that you're seeing, and that's the risk that the Democrats were hoping to minimize, because Graham Plattner, he's got some he's got some personality going, and I think they were hoping he could ride this out once the snakes started coming out of the grass, so to speak.
Brad, I'm going to fall on my sword here. I could talk fairly intelligently for about 60 seconds about populists, but flesh it out for us. Like, when you say that on the left and on the right, describe that movement for me.
A populist movement is basically rooted in emotion, not in logic. So for example, Reagan was not exactly a populist. Even though people loved him, he wasn't exactly a populist, because he was coming out with plans and ideas that were based on, you could agree with them or disagree with them, right? But he had plans. I've got a three-core plan. I want to reduce taxes. I want to improve the defense spending of our country, and I want to reduce the size of government. Those are logical plans, not emotional plans. When you look at populism, whether it's Bernie Sanders, whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's Graham Plattner, It's not based on logic or a plan. It's based on someone's getting screwed, someone's doing the screwing, and if you elect me, I'll fight for you to stop you from being screwed. And it's basically, if you look back at 1913, it was very much the same thing. We saw the same thing also under Teddy Roosevelt administration. He was a true populist. He didn't have specific detailed plans. He just went out there and said, bully, I'm going to fight for you. And people liked him. Right. So that's the essence, I think. And maybe a political science professor might disagree with me. But if you look at each and every one of these populist movements from either the right or the left, they're not based on a plan. They're not based on logic. They're based on emotion.
So at least with Teddy Roosevelt, at least my impressions is that he is one of the greatest presidents. So even though he may not have had a specific plan, he must have figured one out, right?
Well, he did things, but not according to ideology. All right. He did not. He came in and said, I'm going to fight for national parks. That didn't fit within a national some sort of a ideology. It fit within his scheme that he loved to be outdoors. All right. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, if you look at him and William Howard Taft being back to back presidents, that to me is a masterclass. Both were Republicans, but Taft looked at the Constitution by saying, I'm not going to do anything unless the Constitution tells me I can do it.
Yeah.
Roosevelt said, I'm going to do everything I can unless the Constitution tells me I can't. And so those are two different visions. That's why I love those guys next together historically, because you can learn from that.
Brad, we only have like 60 seconds left, but I wanted to bring this up to you. I think lawyers are the most disappointing professionals ever. Like, we let some real idiots out. I think law school's too easy. I'm watching, like, you know, the Charlie Kirk stuff, and I'm watching these people, and I'm like, you got this case? Like, big cases have lawyers that seem like they couldn't litigate their way out of a wet bag.
Oh, 100% agree. Listen, I know some lawyers that are pure idiots and morons. Okay, I know them. I'm not going to give them names, but I could tell you privately over after about the fourth beer. But the point being is that, yeah, I think law school needs to be tougher. I think there needs to be more screening. But listen, law schools are about making money.
Yeah.
And if they get tougher, that means fewer people go. They make less money, just like any education center in our country.
All right, brother. Thank you. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys.
It's not in the way that you came back to me.
Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. Time to talk to our pal Ricky Horton. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well, my brother. Doing well. Thank God we got that win last night. Jeez.
Oh, man. Well, you know what we finally did is we found a guy who was having a birthday that day. So apparently, you know, it was Michael McGreevy's birthday yesterday, and he was nailed. He was awesome. And what I heard after the game was 8 times in a row when a Cardinals starter has started on his birthday, they've won. No team has that kind of record. So my thought is, do we know anybody who was born on July 9th that we can just sign for today and have them go out there? But, yes, we needed it. You know, the Brewers have been obviously playing good. But, you know, the other thing I'd say, though, about us needing it is – we're only 4 days removed from having one of the best road trips you could possibly imagine. That just happened.
Yes.
So it's funny how I feel like because of the last 2 seasons, we get panicky faster than we used to. And I think that's understandable.
It's
understandable, though.
Yeah. So, Rick, you don't have to be a ball player at all to watch Mizrowski and know there's something special going on. But as a former pro pitcher, just analyze him for me.
Yeah, well, you know, I used to say back in my day, you know, the question always was, who would you pay to see play? My answer was always Nolan Ryan, because he was the guy of that era that was just eye-popping. And Mizrowski is eye-popping in the same way. Nobody's throwing 105, 106 miles an hour on the planet. And, I mean, 7 billion people, and he's the hardest-throwing guy. And you get to watch him play. I mean, that's a pretty cool thing, right? Really, if you think about it. And it's pretty heady stuff. But, you know, what's interesting about him is the dude kind of pitches, too. He's not kind of a one-trick pony. He has a good little slider. He throws a little cutter. And, I mean, he's just got it all, honestly. And so he's head and shoulders above everybody, as long as, you know, he doesn't make mistakes, which fortunately he did a couple of times.
Yep.
Cardinals got a couple of home runs off of him, but not enough to beat him.
I love that Herrera, an hour before the game, turned the pitching machine up to 107.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's called prep, isn't it? How about that prep? I mean, and there's so many tools out there right now for players to do those kind of things. Visual tools. You can, you know, kind of pitch a hit off of a guy, you know, kind of virtually, and they have machines and setups to do that. So, I mean, it really is pretty amazing how hard you have to work to catch up to 106. That's what, 0.4 seconds after it leaves his hand to where it's at home. And not only do you have to time it right, you better be swinging at the right spot and better know that it's not coming at your head.
That's right. Yeah, I was thinking about that, Rick. I never made it high enough in baseball. I don't think I've ever been hit by a pitch faster than 75. And so watching these guys get hit by 100-mile-an-hour pitches, seeing McGreevy take one to the sternum, line drive at 104, like, I mean, we know that they're different, not from us because you're one of them, but different from me, but sometimes they just seem like aliens.
Yeah, no doubt. I actually remember when I saw the McGreevy thing, the first thing I thought of was my good friend Todd Worrell getting hit in the chest by Jeff Blauser with the Braves. He got hit by a line drive. And what happens in those moments, you throw it so fast, you're getting rid of it, and it's already there. You're still kind of finishing your pitch. He hits it so fast, you're almost still finishing your pitch, and then you get hit. I mean, it happens, boom, boom, like that.
Yeah.
And we're all got hit in the chest, and it was like a Charlie Brown cartoon. It, like, knocked him off the back of the mound. So the way I told the story last night is, after the game, we were kind of, once we found out he was breathing, we said, you know, hey, that was funny. He goes, no, it's still not funny. He still didn't like it.
That's great. What was what's the worst shot you took?
I took one off my thigh by a guy named Juan Benitez in Baltimore when I was pitching for the White Sox, and it was the same deal. I threw the pitch, he hit it, I was still finishing my pitch, and I was feeling it in my thigh. I ran over, threw him out at first base. I hobbled over, threw him out at first base, walked in, it was the final out. And the manager said, you're out of the game. And I said, no, I'll be fine. He said, no, you won't. And he was right. I mean, it bruised up and swelled up, and there was no chance. I was hobbling around for a couple of days.
Rick, we've talked about this a lot, just the genius of the game of baseball, the fact that the bases were laid out perfectly in the 1800s, it still works.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking about, because I know the season always hasn't always been 162, but it seems just unavoidable that after 162 games, it's going to reveal who you are, and you are what your record says. You've earned it.
Yeah. It always happens that way. And we're at a time where I think the Cardinals have proven that they can be resilient enough to still keep playing. I mean, they're going to have their ups and their downs, but they're still kind of, you know, you can't say it's fluky now when you're up to close to 100 games played. I mean, it's like, okay, that's who they are, is a team that's going to be scrappy, young. Jordan Walker's going to be good. Herrera's going to be a good hitter. Weatherholt's, I mean, you've got more than you thought you had. So just enjoy that and go along with the ride. And by the way, it's time for us to start rooting against Miami. You know, forget rooting against the Cubs. I mean, you can, because that's fun. But I think the team that we're most interested in losing every night right now is the Miami Marlins, because in 3 or 4 weeks, when we start paying more attention to wild card possibilities, that's going to be a team we're going to be competing with.
Okay. I've been listening with great interest to Wheeler and Ackerman and Pauly and these guys talking about this conundrum that we faced, certainly since Dustin May took one off the ankle and we out in the first inning.
Yeah.
But this whole, like, I know the guys don't always agree with him, but I love how definitive Ollie is about his decisions. And I have to praise him for prioritizing long-term health over winning a game or two.
Yeah, and that's what he did in the doubleheader against Milwaukee, and there's a large segment of people who didn't like what he did, but what he did, he had to do because of what you just said. He had to get extra rest for McGreevy, which showed last night. Now, McGreevy was adamant that he didn't need it, but I would say he did. And Pallante getting an extra day, they were both kind of benefit from that, and that's what he's doing. He's protecting guys for the long term because he wants McGreevy and Pallante to be strong in August and in September and for the rest of their career. And the Cardinals pitchers just don't get hurt as much. Radjic got hurt last week, but you know, you're right. Ollie does a great job of protecting guys. And by the way, you use the word conundrum, and that makes me think of something John Rooney's been saying every time I use a big word. He says, there's a word you don't hear in the clubhouse very often.
That's what Mike
Shannon used to say all the time.
That's great.
I love it.
That's great. Rick, is the All-Star break long enough to make any real difference on the bodies of the guys?
Yeah, I think the biggest difference that it makes, well, you get to rest. I think rest is a workout. I'm learning that in a podcast I'm listening to, is don't forget rest is part of your workout. Rest is a workout day, and what you're doing is you're working on letting your body reform muscles and all of that. I mean, I think it's a terrific thought, and the All-Star break is that. However, for pitchers especially, don't be surprised when the guys come back after the All-Star break and their command isn't as good. There's something about not touching a baseline. They're going to try to touch a ball as much as they can, even on those off days. But you can kind of get off kilter a little bit with your mechanics and your feel, and that typically happens for pitchers post All-Star break.
Rick, I just saw that Jordan Walker is going to take part in the Home Run Derby. You've seen him take BP a million times. How do you think he'll do?
Well, the next time I watch the Home Run Derby will be the first time I watch the Home Run Derby, because I don't like it. I can't stand it.
I knew that.
But it's just not my thing. It's like the antithesis of the game to me. And so it's like watching, if you're a golf fan, watching a long drive competition. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can watch it for 2 minutes and then, okay, that's enough. I'm done. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, the guy hit it 400 yards. Next guy hit it 400 yards. They can't golf, but they can do that. Mm-hmm. So I just don't like the Home Run Derby. But I think Jordan will be good at it. And I'm kind of glad he's doing it, because I think the more recognition he gets is a good thing for the Cardinals. It's a good thing for him personally, and I think it's a good thing to get his story out there about just what he's been able to do coming back from where he was the last couple of years.
I agree. Rick, one more topic here, and I know that you guys have to be careful and not get too political about the club, I'd love to get your thoughts on just this, you know, a why in the road, you know, and I think the Cardinals organization have to be happy at how much passion there is for the team this year, but they can't make long-term decisions just to make people happy for the next few weeks. Like, and I know Haim has said from the beginning, if there's a short-term decision and a long-term decision, I'm always going long, but talk a little bit about that as we're only like 25 days from the trade deadline.
Yeah, I think the biggest risk is to make 20% of people happy by doing a move that doesn't make sense, which in the long runs makes 70% or 80% of people unhappy. And I think, so you're always going to have people unhappy with what you do. It's just, you know, that's life, right? But I think they're committed to not making a decision that's going to hurt 2027, 2028. It doesn't mean you're not trying to compete. Obviously, they've been doing that. So to make a splash that hurts your, you know, every team has a board of who they think is going to be on their team next year, the next year, and the next year. I've seen those boards in their special coaches rooms. I mean, they plot it out for 3 or 4 years down the road. And if you're talking about subtracting something from 2029 in order to win a wild card in 2026, I think, you know, you're going to think twice about doing that.
That's good analysis. What's on your agenda other than getting out on the golf course for your All-Star break?
Oh, Ann and I are going to go to Big Cedar Lodge. We're going to have a nice little trip and just kind of enjoy a couple of nice dinners and just kind of get away. And we're, you know, the season is kind of hard on a marriage, so we're grateful to get together and just have some time, her and I.
That's awesome, brother. You deserve it. Have a great time. And tonight I'll be in the section right below you, front row. So give me a wave.
Oh, I will definitely do that. Come see us.
All right, my pal. Are you pretty women? You're so far in between. I don't need no. Welcome back, DGS 249. We have Wiggins coming up at 3. Dave Murray, 3:30. Mike Elam's going to be here to talk Amendment 4 and 5, which I'm very interested in, at 4 p.m. Rach, tell me about the high school team trying to hold on to their name.
I love this story. So I believe this is out in California. Yes. There is a high school, Marysville High School, who have, their mascot has long been known as the Indians. And, you know, it's 2026. A lot of people are saying, like, you got to get rid of Indians as your mascot name. We don't like that anymore. And there's actually a law in California that prohibits K through 12 schools from using, quote, derogatory Native American terms as team names or mascots. But there's a big carve out in that law, and that is schools can keep using them if they are able to secure written approval from a nearby federally recognized tribe.
Hmm.
So what Marysville High School has been doing is they have been reaching out to local tribal representatives and saying, will you please sign off and allow us to keep our name? And the tribes have opted to remain neutral.
Huh.
They say they offer neither support nor opposition and no written consent. So, I don't know. I just think that's kind of funny. Like, we get to keep our name because everybody's cool with it.
Right, right.
Hey, we just need you to sign this thing saying you're cool. And they're like, nah, we're good. We're not gonna get involved, but we're also not going to tell you that it's okay. Which is kind of funny.
Yeah. I respect that position.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, just saying, like, look, you guys can handle this one amongst yourselves.
Is it the Freeburg Midgets across?
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
And remember that a couple years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And people complained and they had a hearing and they listened to everyone and they were like, nah, we're going to keep it. Sorry to disappoint you.
That's what they wanted to do.
Speaking of we people, the Minions, you've always had them clocked as satanic?
I've always known that the Minions were of Satan, yes. But now moms across the country are finally waking up to the fact that the Minions are of the devil. That's because this new movie that's coming out, Minions and Monsters, has the Minions opening a spell book and summoning a spell in order to achieve whatever ends that the Minions are getting
that's
into.
That's enough right there.
Mm-hmm.
So that is causing a little bit of satanic panic. But I've been saying this whole time. Don't let those Minions into your home.
Look, as far as I'm concerned, anything that takes the Minions out, I'm for.
Let's not forget, the Minions are canonically evil.
Yeah, they work for evil people.
They work for villains.
So this movie that's coming out now, Minions and Monsters, is set in 1927. And the Minions accidentally become silent movie stars in Hollywood. But then they lose their fame with the rise of the talkies, because if you know anything about Minions, you know they only speak Minionese.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not able to learn their lines and participate in the talkies movies. So they get a hold of an evil sorcerer that they actually used to work for, because they're satanic.
They're Minions.
And they resort to witchcraft in order to summon the monsters, thus Minions and Monsters.
That's the year my mom was born. I wonder if she's in it.
1927.
She's one of the Minions.
Oh, completely could have been. 4'6", full of pure fury. Difficult to understand at best. Yeah, she could have done that.
I have never seen any of the... I've never seen Despicable Me. I've never seen any of the Minions movies. So I don't know much about them.
Yeah.
But there is a young lady on TikTok who is fluent in Minionese.
I've heard of this.
And she will sing... like popular songs in Minionese, but she does it very straight, very serious.
Yeah.
And it is one of my favorite things to stumble across.
I think people
she does
speak,
an amazing job.
People speak Klingon.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Klingon, Elvish.
Elvish is a big one.
Sindarin, which I think is slightly different from Elvish.
We should make up our own language.
We should make it up really fast before Kevin gets back.
Oh, there you go.
And then we just do the show in that language on
He wouldn't
one
even
day.
Care, though. That's the thing, is we could be speaking in a totally
yell
different language.
At us. What are you doing?
No, he'd be like, I don't care.
What?
You're not making any sense.
What? What is this? What is this? And why would you be doing it?
I got at least 5 texts last night from friends, which is rare, talking about the show. And they were so mad at Wheeler. Because of his take on Widow's Bay.
It was a bad take. Not to get after my boy when he's not here, but it was a bad take.
It's
the only time to get after him.
I keep thinking the show's name is Widow's Peak.
Yeah, because of the hair. It's a hair thing.
I always had the opposite of a Widow's Peak. And the old reverse. Do you guys hear this terrible story from, I think it's South America, where a flight instructor took up a student.
Yes.
And then said to the student, a young woman, you know how to land this plane, and jumped out.
Yes. Monstrously cruel thing to do to someone.
Yeah.
Like, aside from the fact that you're, like, taking your own life in front of another person, which I think is a very, very cruel thing to do to them.
Agreed.
To do it in a situation where there is a high chance that they themselves will not be able to survive it is unimaginably cruel.
Don't make your last act on Earth a total D move.
Mm-hmm.
Just in case.
But she was able to land the plane.
Yeah, good for her.
I guess he was right.
Just traumatized for life.
Mm-hmm.